From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark, here again with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, talking with you about what's new in healthy living, sharing some down-to-earth advice and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, the number to call is 1-800-462-7413. And along with your calls, some topics to talk about.
Yes, Zorba. Skipping breakfast. Is it bad for you? And if so, what should you eat for breakfast? And what do the studies say? We'll talk a bit about that now. And the measles epidemic. What shall we do? We thought measles was out of this country in the year 2000, and it's not. Whose responsibility it is to get vaccinated? What are we doing as a society? This is a dangerous disease. You can see where I am on the side of this topic.
Yeah, no argument from here. What's our recipe?
Thai, basil, chicken bowl, and you said you love it. Come on.
I'm looking forward.
How often do you say, I love this recipe? I mean, this is a Tom Clark recipe. I might even get you to cook it. Oh, I don't know about that,
if I knew how to turn on the stove, I'd do it. 800-462-7413 is our number. 800-462-7413. To the phones we go, Zorba, welcoming our first caller, a listener in Sandpoint, Idaho. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Zorba. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, how can we help?
I have a question today about the harms of secondhand vaping. My partner, Michael, has been smoking cigarettes for about 35 years. He's 54 now.
Uh-huh.
And I'm happy to say that he's been trying to quit for about a year.
Uh-huh.
He's gone cold turkey, he's chewed Nicorette gum,
uh-huh.
and most recently he bought a vape pen. So I'm really glad to see he's making a step in the right direction. As a smoker, he was really courteous, and he always smoked outside of the home.
Mm-hmm.
But now he's been vaping, and he's vaping inside the house. And we're having some disagreements about the harms of vapor, and I've read a little bit about the nanoparticles and toxins, and I wondered how bad they really are. Because we both work from home. And about a week ago, I got a headache, and I started reading more about it. So
uh-huh.
I just thought I would turn to you and ask your thoughts about it.
What a good point, and how interesting is this? You know, it took us years and years and years before we discovered that secondhand smoke actually caused a lot of deaths. I mean, you know, my mom smoked two packs of cigarettes a day. My grandfather lived with us for a while. He smoked a pack of cigarettes, pack and a half of cigarettes. My father smoked a cigar all the time in the house. There was a cloud for the first 18 years of my life. I lived in a cloud. Everyone in my family smoked. When they came over to play bridge like two or three times a week, they all smoked. And then everyone stopped smoking except my dad. He continued with cigar. He lived until 87, so you could say, oh, tobacco never caused him any problems. Well, he was one of the lucky ones. He didn't. But my mom died of dementia, probably or possibly based on the smoking.
Mm-hmm.
But what about this secondhand smoke? Lo and behold, somebody does some studies and says, yes, secondhand smoke is bad. And now we have smokeless bars and taverns in Wisconsin because the studies have shown secondhand smoke is bad for you. We don't know about vaping smoke, except we don't know what's in the vapor. So we know the vapor, the stuff that you're actually aerosolizing, is not regulated by the FDA. They can put whatever they wanted to. It's short of cocaine. They can put what they want to. They cannot put cocaine in there. They cannot put morphine or opioid products. Believe me, if they could put opioid products into the vaping, they would do it. Certainly some people would do it. But it's not regulated. A lot of it is made in China. A lot of it is made in factories you don't know. So in other words, you don't know what you're actually getting when you're vaping. Now, for the smoker, which is worse, tobacco or vaping? On my mind, there's no doubt about it. Tobacco is much worse. Why? We know it's a carcinogen. We know it's bad for you. We know it's bad for your heart. So get off of it. Vaping, we don't have the long-term data, but the thought is, it's probably not as bad because it is not a tobacco product. In other words, we have nicotine. It's in there that may be derived from tobacco, but on the other hand, we have nicotine gum and we have nicotine inhalers that have been tested by the FDA, and they're safe. They don't cause cancer. They don't cause heart disease and so on. So I think for the smoker, it's a great idea to go for vaping. I'm really far from it. I think, by the way, part of the issues with it, we've got to look at kids and vaping and how they're getting into tobacco.
Mm-hmm.
Let's put that off to the side. Now, what about you? He should vape outside. why we don't know what's in there, and you don't want to breathe it in. And we know the cleanest air is the air without any toxin. And if he's vaping inside, the toxin is inside the air, and it's secondhand vape. And we will not know for 10 or 20 years, probably, because we don't have enough data, whether or not it causes any problems, even for the vapor. You know, we don't know about vaping people and whether or not there's chronic lung disease. It takes, by the way, remember, 25 years, 20 or 25 years, 30 to 40 years before you get heart disease, before you get stroke, before you get lung cancer on tobacco. So we don't really know what the dangers are of vaping in the long term, but we do know that secondhand vaping might be like secondhand smoke. Kick them out of the house. You've been together long enough.
Thank you. I appreciate that. I am proud of him for taking that
much
step.
Much better. Let me give you an interesting thing. Nicorette gum, the people who take Nicorette gum to quit smoking, about 5 to 7% continue chewing the gum. So in other words, they continue with their nicotine dependence, but it's safer. He may continue with vaping dependence, but I think it's safer. And I think it's okay. But you don't want toxins in your air, and you don't know what's in there. So
no.
That's the answer.
Well, thank you. Appreciate that.
My pleasure.
Let's change the subject. Breakfast. Skipping breakfast. How is that harmful at all?
Well, first of all, let's talk about breakfast. Breakfast for kids, really, really, really important. Study after study after study has shown that children learn better if they have breakfast. And that's why we have breakfast in school for kids who are breakfast deficient, who have food, you know, who are at a food desert and have food problems. Typically, a child might have dinner at 6 o'clock in the evening. They might have lunch at 12 the next morning. They're basically fasting for like 12 to 16 hours. It's not good for those little brains. And they do better if they have breakfast. The question is breakfast important for adults? Mm-hmm. So there's some interesting studies that came out. So this was a study looking at cardiovascular health. And these were people who were followed for an average of 17 years, okay, for 17 years. 60% of them had breakfast every day, about 25% had breakfast on some days, and about 1 out of 8 never had breakfast at all. They looked at the number of people who had cardiovascular deaths, deaths from strokes, deaths from heart attacks. Those who ate breakfast had fewer deaths. That's what they showed. So in other words, it appeared, once again, it's not a double-blind placebo-controlled trial. These are observational trials. Many studies have shown, and this study goes along with it, skipping breakfast is related to a high risk of diabetes, hypertension, high blood pressure, and so on. But it may also be, it's not just breakfast, it might be people eat breakfast, also engage in other good health things. Mm-hmm. In other words, if you eat breakfast, it's better. But this particular study looked like breakfast was important, but what about eggs?
What about them?
Well, that's interesting. A recent study of 30,000 men in JAMA, 30 men and women, showed that eating a couple of eggs, one or two eggs a day, was actually bad for your cardiovascular health. Mm. In other words, for years, we've been saying that eating breakfast is okay and having some eggs are okay. And then this study goes around and says, wait a minute, really, it is not okay. And then if we compare it to another study, which was the Physician's Health Study, showed that eating an egg a day or a couple of eggs every other day was really okay and healthy. And it actually showed in a number of studies have shown that if you ate eggs for 2 to 3 weeks, 2 to 6 weeks, something in that nature, that your cholesterol didn't necessarily go up and you could eat eggs. Mm. So where does that leave us?
Breakfast is good and probably eggs are good.
Well, I think breakfast is important. I think not fasting turns out to be important for a couple of reasons.
I can't imagine not eating breakfast.
Well, you see, I'm an occasional breakfast eater. I don't eat breakfast every day.
You don't?
No, I do not eat breakfast every day. I would fit into the occasional realm. I'm often not just hungry. However, I often, if I don't eat when I get up in the morning, I eat at about 10 o'clock in the morning. So, I mean, I may not get up and have breakfast then, but I have breakfast at 9 or 10 o'clock, and I might have a handful of nuts. I might have a pastry because I like to have pastry. I might have yogurt. I'll have something. In the weekend, I'll have eggs. But what about eggs? I think having 1 to 2 eggs every day is probably not in your best interest. I think that not having eggs at all probably doesn't make a difference, even though there are a number of people who still eat egg beaters and a number of cardiologists who go, never touch an egg. It's really bad for you. I think eggs are okay. And I think that not having them every day is really the answer to it, because once again, it's a variety of foods that make a difference. But I think a couple of days a week, 2 to 3 days a week, having an egg or two is okay. So is science behind me? Depends on which study you look at. One study says, yeah, way to go, Zorba, you got it. And another study says, no, not way to go, Zorba, you got it. Once again, science is messy, and sometimes we don't have the exact answer, so you choose.
1-800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. 800-462-7413. Back to the phones we go now, Zorba. A listener with us in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
Well, you know, I've got a right knee that's bone on bone. Cartilage is gone. I'm very athletic. I like keep my body fat below 11%.
Wow.
I lift. I do yoga.
Wow.
I'm in my early 50s. Uh-huh. And they've been prescribing a new knee for me for about 10 years now.
So you had this since you were in your 40s.
Yeah, well, active. I was a college athlete.
So you were a college athlete. What did you do in college?
Ice hockey.
Ice hockey. Yeah. The knees. Okay. So we've got ice hockey. You guys banged yourself up all the time. You know what I mean? That hockey players just, you know, just banging. Yeah, banging up all the time.
It's true. Yeah, and I was a goaltender, and it tends to make your knees.
Oh, you were a goaltender. Okay, so you're a goaltender. You know, I've heard hockey is a contact sport. I mean, that's what I've heard about it. So.
It's true.
Okay. So for 10 years ago, they said you've got some knee problems, and now you're in your 50s. All right.
Right, and it's not getting any better, obviously.
No.
But now the technology seems to be catching up with it. Cartilage replacement.
Maybe.
Well, maybe. I'm doing it here at the University of Minnesota at Mayo. Because I'm in Minnesota. But they don't like to do it on anybody over the age of 55. In fact, they don't really like to do it over with anybody even, you know, out of their 20s. So I guess what I'm asking is, you know, do you think the technology is there? Do you think, and because a total knee replacement is, you know, you don't come back from that, right? They chop your tibia.
Well, first of all, let's put the total knee replacement off to the side, first of all. Cartilage replacement is the gold standard of orthopedic health. If we knew how to grow cartilage, we would have so many people who would have these injections. There are billions of dollars a year spent on trying to find cartilage replacement. I don't know what the number is. It's not published, but I would guess at least $2 to $3 billion, because there is so many knee and hip problems that once we find that, if we do, cartilage replacement is going to be the gold standard, and knee replacement will not be there except for the extreme case. Give you a good example of a technology. We do stents now for cardiovascular health. If you go back 30 years ago, a lot of people had open heart surgery. They don't have open heart surgery anymore. They have stents. Why? Because we developed a technology for it, and it worked. The technology for cartilage is not where it's going to be 10 years from now. Okay. Now, you may decide you can try it, and if your insurance will pay for it. Have you looked into this?
I looked into it. There are some procedures that they will cover, and it's not an injection so much as it's a grow the cartilage outside the body and implant it.
Well, they implant it. They put it. They invade the body and put it in. Does your insurance cover that?
I actually talked to the. I won't say which company it is, but I talked to the rep about it. The sales rep that sells the box. I work as a medical illustrator from time to time. So, and he's saying that insurance will cover it.
See, that's Mayo, so first of all, that's the issue. If your insurance covers it, what's the downside of trying it? I don't find a big downside. You might say, hey, I want to try it. I'm an athlete. I want to see if this will work. And they may say, sure, we're going to do it. You're an athlete. You're going to rehab it the right way, and we'll see if it'll work. It's still in that experimental phase. And that's why I ask about the insurance, because a lot of insurances do not cover it. Do I trust the rep to be right? The rep wants you to do it. Come on.
Yes,
you call the insurance company, and you ask the insurance company, and if so, you must get a pre-authorization. You don't have it done unless the insurance company gives you that special number, which is a pre-auth that says they're going to do it. I don't see a downside to it. Mayo Clinic, Great institution. You don't get better than Mayo Clinic for doing it. But now let's go to knee replacements. Knee replacements are awesome. The technology on artificial joints is dramatically better than it was 20 years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago. We used to say, don't do it in a 50-year-old because you're going to have to replace it in 10 years. I don't remember the last time somebody had their knee replaced unless there was a problem with the knee. And there is a problem. Sometimes the cement wiggles and there has to be a second knee replaced. That is true. And I don't know what that percentage is. It might be 5% of the time. That'd be 7. It might be as high as 10%. I don't think it is, but there's some number that's there. But a lot of people who have knee replacements are wonderful. They get back to their sport and they do it. So I wouldn't disparage knee replacements and what you can and what you do. But you are limited into certain sports you can do with knee replacement. You can't be an NFL linebacker, but obviously you're not going to do that. And although you can skate, I don't know if I would take a chance of engaging in hockey if I had a knee replacement. You know, I would pick a sport that wouldn't be that kind of sport. Does that help you?
Kind of. You know, I know a lot of guys that have those knee replacements, it has not been my experience that anybody returns to their sport. But maybe you're the doc. So,
well, what sport do they want to return to?
Most guys want to do tennis. At my age, they like tennis. They like racquetball. Uh-huh. They like jogging. But jogging is off the list. I mean, there's no way you're doing that kind of repetitive motion.
So one of the things I would do, bring up some good examples. First of all, the people who don't get back to their sport are the ones that are the loudest because they didn't get back to their sport. So one of the things, you know what I mean? The squeakers, the squeaky wheel people are the ones who talk. One of the things you might do when you're looking at a knee replacement is when you're going to your clinic, say, I'd like to talk to some people who had a knee replacement who were athletes and got back to their sport. I'd like to see what that is. And then you talk to those people and you see, what did you do? What didn't you do? Because this is very important to you. On the other hand, between 40 and 50, you have not been able to do what you want to do. And so you've got to look at, what am I going to be able to do? And once again, you've got an experimental procedure. If the insurance pays for it, I don't see a downside. See if that'll work. But if not, you've got to say, well, how am I limiting my life? Do I want to wait another 5 or 10 years to see if this experimental procedure improves? A lot of money spent in the technology. It might get better over the next 5 or 10 years. Or do I want to go for it and get a knee replacement so I can do something? So I think the technology and cartilage replacement has a reasonable chance of getting better over the next 10 years, but it may not. We may not actually have the answer. We think science will give us the answer, but growing the cartilage, putting it in the knee, it's still experimental. If the insurance covers it, I'd go for that first.
I think that's good advice. I appreciate it.
We thank you very much. Before we take a break, Zorba, time now for the segment where a real-life doctor, that's you, squares off against the mighty, mighty Internet. We call it Google Doc.
Our producer, by the way, is dancing. That's it. Carl's dancing in the production room.
The following email came to us from a listener named Jane in Greenland, New Hampshire. Hi, Dr. Zorba. I saw a company online that offers testing for allergies, intolerance, or sensitivities to food and environmental items, metals, toxicity, nutrition, gut bio, digestive, and metabolism analysis, and hormones. One can choose how many things they want to be tested for, with the range from 100 to 800. Uh-huh. The three levels prices are $19, $32, uh-huh, and $64. Uh-huh. It looks like the testing is done via uh-huh a hair sample.
Ooh,
do you
ooh
feel this ooh is legit?
Ooh, cut your hair and send it in, and we'll tell you what's wrong with you.
I think you are quacking up,
ooh,
aren't you?
I just love it. I love it. I love it. Yeah, do you have to sit in front of a crystal ball at the same time? Maybe that's what they do. They put it in front of a crystal ball. They look at the hair sample and tell what's going on. Save your money. Don't send your hair in. Do you want to send your hair in? Go ahead. Send it to me. We'll tell you what you're allergic to. We'll throw a dart at a board and do that. It doesn't work. You can't tell. I would say hair analysis is a thing of the past. We used to think at one point it would be useful because, among other things, I believe it was lead poisoning we could tell from a hair sample. But that was about it. Nope. Save your money. Doesn't work. Mm-hmm. Quack, quack, quack.
Did you see something online that you're not quite sure about?
Quack, quack.
Zorba's here to clarify the clickbait. Just post on
quack
our Facebook
bait,
page or send us an email at
Zorba at WPR.org.
Our tasty recipe. Our recipe is coming up along with more of your calls, of course, right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange.
Fashion impaired, but I'm not colorblind. I just have bad taste. If you look today, I have stripes going two different ways. These stripes go down, and these stripes go this way. Luckily, Penny did not see me dressed this morning, so I got out of the house.
Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That number is 800-462-7413. But Zorba, before our next call, Thai basil chicken bowls.
That's right. So do you like Thai food?
I do.
Yeah. I like Thai food, too. Yeah. I like Chinese food and Thai food. I was thinking the other day, it's quite amazing. Years ago, we gave away aprons. Do you remember the aprons?
No.
There were aprons that we gave away because I found one in the house, and it said Zorba's Oriental Chicken. And I was looking at it thinking, we don't use terms like that. Because like 25 years ago, Oriental, we would not use the word Asian, Oriental. That word has gone out. No reason. I mean, it's not a bad word. We don't use it for whatever reason.
We gave these away to listeners?
We gave it away when we went to conventions. But we didn't specify. And it had some Thai seasoning in the Oriental chicken. So it was interesting. I was looking at the recipe. I found this old apron. Nonetheless, getting back to the recipe, it's Thai. Basil, of course, is really part of Thai food, and a chicken, a really easy, simple recipe. Lots of things that are in the recipe. So, you know, if you don't want to text when you drive and get into a crash, kind of listen to it. You can come to our website and do it in the smart way, or you can even take a picture of it on the website. Okay. Start out with one cup, if you have it, preferably jasmine rice.
A cup of jasmine rice.
So it's a white rice. Jasmine rice. You're looking at me like, what's jasmine rice?
I'm still trying to picture somebody taking a picture of the recipe.
No, you take a picture of recipes. If, like right now, I can take a picture with my smartphone of the recipe, and I've got it on my phone. Because it's a picture.
Okay.
You laugh, but that's how we send things. We have.
I know.
Well, you have a dumb phone. Do you have a smartphone or a dumb? You still have a dumb phone?
Oh yeah.
You still? Oh yeah. Right.
My wife has a smartphone.
I know. You have a dumb phone.
Yeah.
But for smartphone pictures, you get information in photos.
Okay.
Thai basil, start out with a cup. If you have a jasmine rice, any white rice will do, but jasmine rice is really the best if you've got it.
Mm-hmm.
Half cup of chicken broth. Low sodium is good. My favorite, by the way, for chicken is the Better Than Bouillon chicken broth. It is a concentrated bouillon. It is not high in salt. You know, only one company makes it, Better Than Bouillon. It's called Better Than Bouillon. It is the best bouillon that you can buy and you should have on your shelf. So you want to make a half cup of chicken stock. You can also buy, you know, the chicken stock in the bottle or in the can or in the box.
Mm-hmm.
3 tablespoonfuls of soy sauce. Reduced sodium would be the best, but any soy sauce.
2 big tea soy sauce.
There are differences in soy sauce, and so you want to pick one that you like. It may be tamari soy sauce. It may be Kikkoman's, which is made in Wisconsin. Did you know that?
No.
It's made in Walworth, Wisconsin. It's the most number one soy sauce in America that we make in Wisconsin. And anyway, any kind of a soy sauce is good. Tablespoonful of fish sauce.
Mm-hmm. A tablespoon of fish sauce.
This is very important. Just like there's a difference in ketchup. You know, if you buy generic catsup, it doesn't sound the same. It doesn't taste the same, rather, as Heinz ketchup or Hunt's ketchup. It's the same with fish sauce. You want it to be fresh. Get a small bottle. If you're unsure and you go to an Asian grocery store, ask the person at the grocery store. Some of the fish sauce is very important. Some smells fishier. I mean, it's the best way to explain it. But the fish sauce can make a huge difference in this. For me, because I am not Thai, I would pick a fish sauce that is milder.
Mm-hmm.
Ask somebody when you're getting it. And by the way, if you buy a name brand, I think it's called Thai Kitchen, it's going to be a milder fish sauce.
Mm-hmm.
1.5 tablespoons of light brown sugar. Now, when you buy your brown sugar and you store it in your house, do you make sure that you close off all the moisture to the brown sugar bag? I'm just asking you, Tom. Do you do that?
Moving right along.
Moving right along. Very important, or it gets really dry, so it's a real problem. 1.5 tablespoons of unseasoned rice vinegar.
1.5 big tea unseasoned rice vinegar.
2 tea of a vegetable oil, any kind. Olive oil, of course, is fine.
2 tablespoons of vegetable oil.
3 minced cloves of garlic. If you love garlic, just put in even more, 6 or 9 or 10. I use 3 in this recipe, but I often will just add more if I'm in a mood for garlic.
3 plus garlic cloves.
2 shallots thinly sliced. So you can use an onion if you don't have shallots around.
2 shallots, thinly sliced.
A red Thai chili pepper, thinly sliced, if you can get that. If not, you can pick a jalapeno pepper, but pick a mild one. Don't pick a habanero that's going to throw you out of the out of the kitchen.
Red Thai chili pepper, thinly sliced.
1.25 pounds of ground chicken breast.
1.25 pounds ground chicken breast.
That's right. If you don't have that, turkey breast would be okay. And 1.5, and a ground can also be chopped, but ground would be better. 1.5 cup of packed fresh basil leaves.
1.5 cups packed fresh basil leaves.
Which is a lot. Here we go. Mm-hmm. Cook the rice according to package instructions. Set it aside. One of the gadgets I recommend you have in your house, especially if you don't have one, is a rice cooker. I mean, you can do it in an Instapot. Instapot is also a really great device. But cooking either in an Instapot or a rice cooker, you'll get perfect rice every time. I mean, it was one of the first gadgets we ever got in our house, and we have never been without. Easy to use, better than in a pot. In a small bowl, whisk together chicken stock, soy sauce, fish sauce, brown sugar, and vinegar. Set it aside. Now hit the veggie oil or olive oil in a large skillet over medium heat till it starts to be warm. Give it a good minute to 2 minutes before you add the garlic, shallots or onions, and chili pepper. Cook till it's fragrant, about 1 to 2 minutes. Then add the ground or chopped chicken. If you don't have ground chicken, or turkey would be just fine. Cook until it's brown, 3 to 5 minutes, making sure you crumble the chicken as it cooks. You want to have it nice and undense. Drain the excess fat, stir in the stock mixture, and cook, stirring constantly until the sauce has thickened, 2 to 3 minutes. Stir in the basil till it's just wilted, about 30 seconds, and put it on top of the rice. That's it. Mm-hmm. It's delicious. It'll taste really good. This is an easy recipe. And if you want it, you can go to ZorbaPastor.org. It's, again, ZorbaPastor.org, or you can find us through Facebook.
If you'd like to call us, the number is 800-462-7413. Now, Zorba, a listener with us in Chicago, Illinois. Hi.
Hi. Well, thanks for having me on.
Sure.
I was calling because my son, who is 2, has always sort of had a mild case of eczema. Particularly, we get rough patches behind his knees and sort of under his armpits and his elbows. Recently, we were on vacation, and we had a flare-up, and it was really, really bad. I mean, to the point where it was all over his stomach, his back, his neck, and he was, you know, just itching constantly, and we just can't get it back under control since then. We've tried ointments, actually got a prescription oil, but it's bothersome to him. If we try the hydrocortisone, it seems to really bother him. You know, he kind of screams when we put it on. So
really?
I don't like
so it
that
is
a, at all.
So it isn't like the hydrocortisone or Protopic. That's another one that we often give that's not a steroid. So when you put anything on it, does it bother him?
He seems generally okay with the oil, but I know the oil is a steroid, and that's not like a long-term use scenario.
Right.
And lotion seems to sort of be okay for short periods of time, but he'll wake up in the middle of the night and ask for it. He'll say, lotion.
So he's bothered.
Yeah. Is he saying right now, don't talk to that doctor?
He's the background.
You might be able to hear him in the background, but luckily he's not saying that.
He's just babbling. Babble, 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 babble. Have you talked to your family doc, your pediatrician? Who are you taking him to?
I've taken him to our pediatrician, and she's the one who prescribed the oil. Mm-hmm. And
what's in the oil? Do you know what's is it a steroid oil or a steroid oil?
Correct. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. And so they said to use it about 2 weeks, and we're already past that point. So,
well, you know, there are other non-steroid medications for eczema. I believe the name is Protopic, but I can't remember. This goes off my head. You can talk to your pharmacist or talk to your pediatrician, but there are non-steroid ointments that you can use for eczema. And that's what I would – and I don't think the oil is what's in it because it's a cream and it can be an ointment. And that's what you want to go to. You know, as you know, after a couple of weeks, the question is what do we do to get this under control? What you don't want to do but what you might have to do, but that's sort of the last thing you want to do is actually give an oral steroid. But you can do that.
Right.
I mean, we give oral steroids – you know, for children who have asthma flares, and they will often also work for children who have eczema flares. But I would try some other ointments before that. I would try, as I said, I believe it's called Protopic, but don't quote me because I can't remember. Google non-steroid ointment eczema and it'll pop up. And I believe Protopic is one of them. There's several of the other creams. They're more expensive. They're a higher copay. Got to try it. You want to try everything topically to get it under control. But I want... I love the baby. I have a question.
Yeah.
How long after the flare did you jump in with a medicated cream?
It was about a week after.
Okay.
So I tried things at home first.
So in retrospect, what you want to do, because kids often get, many kids get better after they're like 2, 3, 4, or 5. What you want to do in retrospect is if he has a flare, you want to jump on it with whatever works for the flare. Because now you've had the experience of it getting out of control. So you just want to make sure the next time you get it in. But I would say, as I say, one of the other non-steroid ones which are safer, go to that one next. And if not, he may just need a dose of steroids.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
And you have really, something to do right now.
That's right. You do. You do. Hi, baby. Hi, baby.
Can you say hi? All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot for the call.
When I clock to my granddaughter, she clocks back.
Okay. Before the break, Zorba, let's batten down the hatches and sail this radio vessel through the murky ocean of medical quackery. This is Quacking Up with Dr. Zorba.
Quack it up with Dr. Zorba.
Well, actually, Zorba, this is a follow-up to a recent show where we were talking about the medical use of leeches.
Oh, yes.
We ended up getting many emails in response to this discussion, and here are a few. The following email came to us from a listener, Joyce. When I was a student at the UW in the 60s, I worked as a nurse's aide at the UW Hospital on University. One time, I helped with a woman with an enormous bed sore on her back, which was being treated with leeches. It seemed yucky to me, but maybe it was the best treatment at the time.
Probably was the best treatment at the time.
Okay, and this one...
yucky.
This one came to us from Jody.
How about maggots? They're even yuckier than leeches, by the way. I'm sorry.
Can I go on?
Yeah, of course.
This one came to us from Jody in Richland Center, Wisconsin. As an RN at UW Hospital in the 80s and 90s, we used leeches to reduce edema in peripheral vascular wounds.
Oh.
Yes.
Oh, the 80s and 90s.
We housed the little critters in 5-gallon buckets, changing the water routinely. But hey, it's Wisconsin. Leeches aren't just for fishing. Now, Zorba, knowing again that we'd be talking about leeches, I tried again to come up with a few leech jokes.
Okay.
But they still all sucked.
Oh, God.
If you have anything that you'd like to share with us, just post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
More calls coming up, more listener emails, another interesting topic to talk about.
That will not suck.
All right, here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Before we get back to the phone, Zorba, it seems appropriate to talk about measles.
That's right. You know, it's also appropriate to talk about the anti-vaccinators in our society. I think it's an abomination, really. The states with the highest vaccination rate, by the way, are Mississippi and West Virginia, and I compliment them on what they're doing for public safety. They're putting in fines in place. Kids can't go to school, a whole bunch of issues. And here you have these pockets of anti-vaccinators. The anti-vaccinators, for instance, in New York are pockets of Hasidic Jews who have this belief in the vaccine community that all of a sudden it's going to make them sterile. The other pockets are in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington. They tend to be highly educated people who are stupid when it comes to this. And basically, there are roughly worldwide 100,000 deaths a year from measles. Mm-hmm. 100,000 deaths. In the year 2000, actually, the CDC said, we're done with measles. It's not around anymore. And so people started getting lax. They stopped vaccinating their kids. The guy who goes around and says vaccine causes autism, which has been proven not to be the case scientifically, gets $10,000 a lecture. And even though his medical license was taken away in Great Britain, he still gets $10,000 a lecture. And what are we going to do about it? I mean, measles is highly contagious, can be in the room. You leave the room and the virus just stays there. 1 out of 1,000 people or kids die. 1 out of 500 get meningitis and they can have some distinct problem with their memory from that. And you know, these are parents often who are not vaccinated their children. So is this child abuse if you don't give your child a vaccine and they actually get it? Yeah. I mean, what do we do about it?
You might as well be talking in a barrel or to the wall or something. People aren't going to – people who
well,
don't
a lot
want
of people,
that.
A lot of people just don't get education. That's what it is. They don't understand it. What they do is they read the fake news myths that are on social media. And Facebook has actually taken – they've started to actually take and they said, we are going to, quote, quarantine these myths on Facebook. Whether or not they'll actually succeed or not is very difficult.
They won't succeed. I mean, they won't succeed.
Well, we think they won't succeed, but the reality is if they can develop an algorithm to get you to buy something because of the things that you visited on Facebook and Google, they can develop an algorithm to actually get rid of myths that have to do with vaccines. My recommendation, if you have a child, get them vaccinated. Mm-hmm. That's the safest thing. We now know that it's safe. It's proven effective. We have good information that it does not cause autism because we now know in areas where children are not vaccinated, autism is still going up. We don't know what causes autism, but it's not the vaccine. It's important to take care of our children. It's important to keep them healthy, and it means vaccinate them for diseases that may potentially kill them. Be a good parent.
1-800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello, this is Laura.
Yeah, hi, Laura. How can we help?
I'm calling on behalf of my 90-year-old mother. She has multiple health issues from head to toe, but her most vexing issue is what she calls twirling in her eyes and imbalance. And she's seen many, many doctors and had MRIs, and she just had a CT scan recently for her sinuses that came out normal. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't know where to turn or what kind of questions to ask.
Okay, so they put the liquid in the ears, they put in cold, they put in heat, they put her on the goggles, and so they don't know what's going on.
Right. Mm-hmm.
She's been to an ophthalmologist, I take it?
She's probably been to 3 or 4 of them, and she was just at the optometrist last week, and she said while he was examining her eyes, they were twirling, but he didn't see anything.
No, wait a second. While he was examining her eyes, you mean she felt they were twirling, but he didn't see anything?
Yeah, she felt the twirling sensation. Her
eyes were
not moving, which is just weird.
Right. Well, no, so it's an internal sensation. I mean, he was looking at the eye, she had the sensation, and the eye itself wasn't moving, which means it's not the eye moving that's causing it if he didn't notice it when it was going on. So first of all, it's clear we don't know what's causing it, right? I mean, you don't see the eye twirling, and they've done the nystagmus test, and they can't reproduce it. So it may be something that is an inner ear issue. And she may just try over-the-counter antihistamines initially and see if they work. And so she could take Allegra, Claritin, or Zyrtec, which all come in a generic, double or triple the dose. If one pill, if the dose, the usual dose, which is a tablet a day, doesn't work, double it or triple it. See if that does something to it. Okay.
Okay.
Once again, I'd experiment with it and see if that works. If that doesn't work, the next thing I'd try is an anti-seizure medication, a drug like gabapentin or Topamax, and see whether or not that'll make a difference. Why? Well, we know these are good for neuropathic pain. They may work for this within her brain. Once again, she doesn't have a seizure, but we use seizure medications for other things. We use them for chronic pain in the back. We often use it. Lyrica is a very interesting one. It also changes mood. So I would try an anti-seizure medication. I would take it and see whether or not that gets rid of the medication. If that fails, I would try a drug, duloxetine. Duloxetine is an antidepressant, but it works for people with chronic pain, which means it affects pain fibers, and it may then affect the fibers in her brain that are producing this weird sensation that nobody can figure out. I would try 30 to 60 milligrams a day of duloxetine. I would just experiment with these different things and see if they got rid of it. It's clear that scientifically we don't have a method of knowing what's going with her inside her brain, but she has the sensation. So I would just go after the sensation and try these three different drugs, the antihistamine group, the anti-seizure group, and then the antidepressant group, and see whether or not you can decrease the sensation. I'd work for it in the same way with pain. We can't measure pain with people. Mm-hmm. Somebody says they're in pain. We don't have a pain meter, but we all know what pain is, right?
Right.
You know what pain is. We have no way of measuring it, but we know it's real. Your mother has something analogous to pain. She has a sensation that we cannot measure. So let's treat the sensation.
Okay. Is this something her regular physician could prescribe?
Yeah, of course. Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. You now have to encourage the regular physician and just experiment with your mom. But she's 90. She's bothered by it. And if she wants to do it, why not try it?
Yeah, sounds like a good plan.
Good. Excellent.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We
Take
appreciate
care.
That call at 800-462-7413. Okay, Zorba, let's open up the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox now and share a listener tip. The following email came to us from Martha, a retired cultural anthropologist in Austin, Texas. She writes, "Decades ago, a smart young man repairing my roof was observed sometimes putting his hand flat on top of his head. I asked him if he needed a hat. He told me it was his grandfather's teaching, a way to steady himself. I've used this grandfather's trick ever since, usually when climbing ladders, and it always works.
Put your hand on top of your head.
Clamping an open palm on top of my head is a version of what you explained on a recent show to communicate a sense of control, like returning both hands to bicycle handlebars. I will now expand my use of the hand-on-head method for all events of discombobulation. Thank you."
Discombobulation. So when you don't know what's going on, put your hand on top of your head. That's very good. I'm doing it right now.
Yeah.
I feel much more stable in my chair.
That's good. You're not falling off or anything. It works.
But I'm going to try this. That's very interesting. When I feel unsteady, I'm going to put my hand on top of my head and see if I feel steadier.
I'm going to try it too.
Yeah. We'll get back to you folks and let you know whether or not it keeps us straight up.
800-462-7413 if you have a question for Zorba. 1-800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, we welcome a listener in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi.
Hi, how are you, Tom? Dr. Zorba?
Fine. How can we help?
Thank you guys for having me on the show.
Oh, you're welcome.
Big fan.
Thank you.
And I had a kind of an interesting situation happen to me last July where I was asleep, had worked that day, and had a seizure before my alarm went off.
Wow.
My fiance was in bed next to me and obviously freaked out and called the ambulance. And then they came, and by that time I was up and able to respond to them, and they were like, oh, he's okay, and left. And so they left. I went back to sleep and had another one about 20, 30 minutes later.
Wait a second. They came. They said you were okay. 911, the ambulance comes. They show up. They say, we don't have to transport you to the hospital. You had a seizure, which can be reasonable. I mean, it kind of depends on where we are, whatever their judgment was. But then you went back to sleep and had another seizure?
Right.
Wow.
And so she was freaked out again. Called
of
the
course.
Ambulance. Same guys come back and take me to the hospital this time. And thankfully. And so I go in the hospital, and I'm there for a while. And then about early in the afternoon, 2, 3 o'clock, I have a third one. These are, you know, grand mal tonic-clonic seizures.
Right, right.
Both convulsions and everything. And I don't remember hardly any of this.
Of course. That's part of the seizure.
My fiance is traumatized by it. My question is, have you seen this kind of thing happen before? I was 26 at the time.
Yeah.
No family history, no other history of seizures.
What did they do in the hospital? What was your workup?
They did a CAT scan, EEG, and I was there for 3 days and just did some regular tests. The first one, there was some epileptic brainwave, but that was right after it had happened.
Yeah.
And since then, I've gone back and had no activity.
So did they put you on a seizure medication?
Yes, I'm on Keppra, generic Keppra.
Okay, and you've been on it now for how long have you been on it?
Been 9 months and change.
Okay. So you developed epilepsy. The question is, why did you develop epilepsy? And the answer is, we don't know.
Okay.
We don't know a lot of things. Why do some people develop breast cancer? Why do most people who smoke cigarettes never develop lung cancer? They don't. Most people who die prematurely from cigarettes die of heart attacks and strokes. They never get lung cancer. Why do some get it and some don't? We don't know. We don't know a lot of things within medicine. And when it comes to risk factors for epilepsy, we don't know. The CAT scan shows if there's an injury, previous injury for that, but something happened in your brain that started it. And so the answer is a seizure medication. The question is, do you have to be on it for life? Now, that's a different question. Neurologists, which, of course, look at it and they look at all the information, what's the latest information, can say that at a certain period of time that you've been seizure-free. And I don't know what the number of years are. I don't know if it's 3 years or 5 years, but it's a pretty good number of years. Whether or not, and then you have an EEG that's done, and if your EEG is negative, then can you get off the medication? Now, the reason that this is important is, can you get off the medication and drive? In other words, because if you have a seizure when you drive, you can have an accident. And so that's where you and your neurologist say, 5 years down the line, whatever the number is, and I don't – there really are. You can Google it. I don't have a computer in front of me when I do the show. But then you and the neurologist look together and say, okay, well, there's no seizure activity. I had seizures. We don't know exactly why. And some people get off their seizure medication, and they get off it successfully. But some, because we don't have the predictability, get off, and then a certain amount of time later, might be 6 months, 3 months, 1 year, or 2 years – and have a seizure again, in which case they go back to the fact that they can't drive for 3 months if they're in Wisconsin, and then they go back on medication for a lifetime. So that's something that is something that you and your neurologist will answer down the line, not right now.
Sure.
And it might be that down the line we have better predictability. We used to say once you're on it forever. But now we say, no, once you're on it, you may be on it forever, but some people get off of it. Luckily, you weren't in your car. You were home. You were with somebody who knew you. You didn't have an accident, a serious accident. That's the good news. And the medication, how do you tolerate the medication?
It's fine. I felt a little tired when I first started taking it, but now I don't have any effect at all.
Yeah, I mean, the medications are really useful. When I started medicine, we gave phenobarbital. And phenobarbital is a barbiturate, and people were tired all the time. I mean, they were tired. It affected them mentally and other things. Then we had another drug, Dilantin, which was a pretty good drug, but it had significant side effects. It had dental side effects and other side effects. The drug that you're on, Capra, is a good drug. It's been around for a long time. We know how it works. Doesn't have side effects. Take it the right way and do not miss your doses.
Okay, well, thank you very much. That's great to know. On top of my neurologist advice, thank you.
You're welcome. I think it's always good when you've got something chronic to kind of get a second opinion and figure out exactly what's going on. So thank you so much for your call.
Before we head out today, Zorba, let's open up the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and share a listener email. This one came to us from Kelly, who listens to the show on KOSU in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. She writes, "Hi, Dr. Pastor. I'm currently 12 weeks pregnant with my third child, and I've noticed something odd with each pregnancy. After very tough months of bad vomiting and nausea in the first trimester, I crave beets as soon as I can start eating regularly again. Raw or juiced, especially, I love them.
I love beets.
I listen to my body well and do believe that certain cravings are due to needing nutrients. I know that there are many odd cravings in pregnancy, but is there something uniquely special about their nutritional makeup that supports prenatal development?"
I really can't say that beets have something specific in there. I do know that if you eat a lot of beets, your urine might turn red, and then you end up worrying that you have blood. I also know that my wife hates beets, so I can never have beets around the house. My daughter loves beets. My daughter Dee Dee loves beets and often grills them on the grill. I happen to like beets and like beet borscht. I think it's just a good nutritional thing, and if it works for you, use it.
I'm with Penny, by the way, on that one. How does Zorba always have a helpful answer for people? Beats me. Feel free to post on our Facebook page or send us an email at
Zorba@WPR.org.
If you missed anything during the show or want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at ZorbaPastor.org or, of course, through Facebook.
Don't forget you can call us anytime at 1-800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. Our executive producer is Carl Christensen. Our technical director is Brad Kohlberg. Our theme music is by Leo and Ben Sidran. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, asking you to join us on the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Did you miss something on today's show? Simply go to ZorbaPastor.org to catch up on all things Zorba. There you will find recipes from the show, links to the Facebook page, Zorba's Healthy Living articles, and you can subscribe to the weekly podcast. On the web, that's ZorbaPastor.org.